comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous planet. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show, and welcome. We are here because you have a right to know, and because you matter. To all of our listeners in the USA, let me wish you a happy Thanksgiving. I don't think that's a holiday anywhere else. But if it is, happy Thanksgiving to you, too. And I hope you had a great holiday today. Now, I've been getting quite a number of emails and messages over at Facebook and private messages in our members community with people asking if I'm going to make the any of the shows that we did with Command Sergeant Major James Norton public. Am I going to make them available? And the answer, of course, they are available already in our archives, our K-Pods. But the answer to that is yes, we are going to, within the next day or two, we're working on it right now, we're going to make those available for viewing, not just listening, but for viewing and for downloading. If you want to download them, and have the video file, you'll be able to do that. So all of the shows that we have done with Command Sergeant Major James Norton or about him, we're going to make those available. And I don't know, I think there's four or five, maybe six of them, and really powerful stuff. So you'll want to be sure and avail yourself of that. I also want to be sure that I thank Jerry Wills for sitting in for me last night. I had, you remember, a few days ago, last week, as a matter of fact, I had to take the producer to the airport, which is about 2 miles away, 2 miles, 2 hours away. And you remember that night I took him to the airport, and then I came back, and I did the show. And I told you, I walked in literally 3 minutes. I sat down at the mic 3 minutes prior to being on the air. So that was cutting it pretty close. Well, last night I had to go back to that same airport to pick him up, and because of the time of the flight, there was absolutely no way for me to be here at the mic, and Jerry Wills sat in for me. I appreciate him for doing that. I have heard that he did a great job, and I really appreciate his willingness to jump in there and do that. And let me tell you, folks, it's a lot of work. It really is a lot of work. I'm used to it because I do it every day. But if you don't do this every day, and then you have to just jump in and contend with everything that goes into these broadcasts, there's a lot of work, and he was quite willing to do it, and he always has been, and I appreciate him for doing that. I appreciate his wife, Kathy, for putting up with his having to take time, a lot of time, out of their normal schedule in order to be able to do that. It's not just the 2 hours. There are many, many hours that go into it before the 2 hours we're on the air. All right, we're going to step away for break, and we'll be back right after this. All right. right. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is someone who's been with us a number of times before, and it's always a delight to have him with us. His name is Sam Maranto. He is the Illinois MUFON State Director. And for those of you who don't know what MUFON is, that stands for, it's M-U-F-O-N, stands for Mutual UFO Network. And he is the state director in Illinois, and always brings to us interesting and sometimes bizarre reports of UFOs. And I think he's got one this evening that, I don't know if it's bizarre, but it's really, really interesting. Sam, welcome back to the show, and thank you for stepping in here on Thanksgiving to spend some time with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Kevin.
Sam, I got that right, didn't I? It's Illinois MUFON State Director?
Yes, actually, Illinois MUFON NFP, and I'm also the president of the organization here, the corporation. So we have our own chapter here, state chapter, and we have also multiple chapters throughout the state. We have CIF chapters, local community chapters. We encourage a degree of autonomy and let them, you know, up their own, you know, within a certain framework. The whole idea is to disseminate, get the information out there, also to get people who have some sort of interest in this well beyond just, say, for instance, just reading reports or hearing stories of cases, but to actually get out in the field and do some work. So on doing this, we hope to get some investigators, and that's been paying off quite nicely recently.
How many investigators do you have throughout the state?
The funny thing is, active and actually on the books, we have probably about 30 in Illinois, but active currently, it's probably about 4. And that varies depending upon, of course, everybody's scenario and work. Mm-hmm. That's the funny thing about the real world, got to pay bills, et cetera, health. And sometimes people do get frightened or, you know, just feel they're not able to handle this. So that's
what good. What kind of situations would frighten them?
Well, I would say some of these cases are some of the cases are pretty intense as far as realizing that now that you are in, you're looking at something that it is a matter of national security, regardless what anybody says. And I think more so, it's a degree of paranoia. I don't think anything in particular has transpired with any of them, but they feel that maybe something has. So I'm just thinking of two instances in particular. But
well, see, that's one of the very few good things about living in a police state. Now that they're watching every move you make anyway, they're recording every phone call you make, every email is being sucked down, you absolutely are being surveilled and monitored with every breath you take. Now that that's going on, there's nothing to fear about, well, if I do this, they'll start looking at me. They're looking at you already.
They're already looking at you. I think, wasn't it back in 47 they started recording phone calls on a large scale? They had some ongoing relationship with, I think it was AT&T at that point. I think it was 47 they started doing that on a large scale.
I'm not sure about that, but I do know that by the 1970s it had become so absolutely pervasive that the Supreme Court heard several cases and really peeled the FBI's ears back and forced them to stop spying on American citizens so much. They still did it, but not as much. They had to roll it back. Now, every talk show is being recorded. Did you know that? Every single talk show is being recorded, and they're looking for clues in there that could indicate that someone is planning some kind of nefarious stuff. So every talk show is being recorded.
The other thing is hate talk.
Mm-hmm.
What is considered hate talk? Anything, anything against a government, and it doesn't have to be our government. It could be a government. If you're being critical, I guess you could get away with it if you do it in a comical sense or in a fictional portrayal, but you can't do it in an honest commentary.
Ah, land of the free, home of the brave. That means work for free and be damn brave about it. Okay, let's talk about UFOs. And, of course, what we have been discussing does impact UFO investigation. And, you know, for that reason, it does fit in the genre of the show. But you were telling me about a UFO investigation that I don't know if it was you or some of your investigators, but your organization anyway has gotten involved in investigating this UFO report, and in the course of doing so ran into all kinds of Bigfoot evidence.
Yes.
Where is that? What part of the state is that in?
I can only give a general idea.
Okay.
And it would be the central area of the state and south central.
Okay.
Because it's an ongoing case, and we've already had people show up out there with high-powered rifles trying to bag one of these. So we don't want that taking place. We don't want people harassed. We definitely don't want these creatures hurt. They exist. They're there. And it appears they have been there for a very long time. And so we don't want to cause any more ruckus than we already have, you know, by doing night watches, etc. And the other thing is we're limiting the amount of researchers in the area too, because we're trying to keep watch have a control. Too much stimulus. We're trying to watch the reaction. When I say we are, there is the actual individual who's had this UFO activity going on, and the Bigfoot activity has also been very good at being proactive and taking a serious investigative role instead of just reacting to it. She's doing very good work. In addition to two gentlemen that are part of our group and have done Bigfoot research in the field for years in Illinois, Oklahoma, and some other locations.
All right, let's back up and hear about the UFO activity. Describe for us what is it that this lady has reported. What has she been seeing? What has she been experiencing with UFOs?
Her first sighting actually wasn't the one that she called up me on. It was a CMS case that came in through MUFON. The CMS case that she had sent in was an orange orb off in the distance, probably a mile and a half away, above a telephone pole. And she reported this in addition to another sighting. It was about a week afterwards, a triangular pattern of three star-like objects moving about the sky in holding that pattern, that isosceles pattern. And, that could be either independent objects, one thing or another. But she was rather convinced that this was something unusual It moved overhead without any sound and hovered in the distance. She has seen these objects at close range, too, and that is what came to light when I went out there and interviewed her. And that sighting that was very startling was with multiple witnesses. In fact, in most of these cases, if not all, they have been multiple witness sightings, even in some instances with photographs. So that's kind of nice, too. I'd like to have
okay, now, evidence. You said even in some instances with what?
Supporting evidence, photographs.
Oh, photographs, okay. All right, now, this triangular object or this formation, if it was separate objects, how big would she estimate that to be? Are you there, Sam? I believe your phone has died, Sam. Okay, well, we have apparently lost Sam. So we'll give him a call on another line and see what happens. Don't know what happened, but we have Sam back with us, I think. Sam, are you back with us?
Yes, I'm in the world of the living at the moment, I assume.
Okay. Yeah, well, what I did is I called that other number. Mm-hmm. And so maybe it has forwarded to you where you are or something, I don't know. But I thought we'd give that a whirl.
Well, it's working.
Yeah. Okay, so... How big did she estimate this triangle to be?
Well, it was off in the distance, so she couldn't really get an idea how big that was. But in 1997, she was driving down the road not far from her home with her daughter and her mother in the car, and they seen an array of very beautiful lights in a pattern, almost in a lateral, a horizontal line. And it was purple, red, greens, yellows, all these oranges and beautiful colors. So she went down a ways to find out what it was, and it was a large area in the sky. So on seeing this, she was able to actually see a very large triangle hovering over a section of the of a cornfield, if not taking the majority of the cornfield up and just hovering right above it.
Okay. Now, when did this Bigfoot activity start with this same witness?
I personally feel it started since she was there. She always had unusual activity going on, but she couldn't piece the two things together. What had happened was we were out there, and all of a sudden one day she calls me up and she says, "They're on the roof. These things are on the roof. They're tapping the window with sticks. They're doing one thing or another, and I'm like, okay, are you seeing anything? Are you getting an idea of how many there are? And she goes, well, whatever they are, they're heavy because they're on the roof, and it almost sounds like the roof wants to cave in. So on and on this happens for a few days, and I ask her, you know, do you smell anything when this is going on? And she goes, yes, it smells like a cesspool, like, or a pig farm. It's very, very bad smell. And then there's a lot of other mischief going on where the doors are being opened and on and on and on, and somebody's playing with the car. And I go, boy, oh, boy. So I'm thinking, you know, more and more it sounds like Sasquatch, especially adolescent Sasquatch.
Do you think this Bigfoot activity is related in any way to the UFO activity?
I think I would have to say there is a correlation. These things, through the year or so now, or almost a year, that we've been monitoring this, and she's been paying very close attention to it. Anytime there's UFO activity going on, these creatures just get very frightened and don't show up. So there must be a correlation there. Plus, they seem to alarm her that UFO activity is going to take place or is taking place.
How do they do
that?
They
speak. Oh, they speak. They can say words. They usually. She describes the talking very similar to like a sumo wrestler, and very fast, or not like a samurai warrior, real mumbly but real fast. But then they repeat English. They also mimic animals and mimic her mother talking to her. Sometimes she'll think it's her mom talking, and she's nowhere around, and it's them talking outside, calling, and they're experts at tricking people. In fact, Native Americans refer to them as tricksters too.
Well, this doesn't sound like animals. If they can talk, we're not talking about great apes here.
No, they're very intelligent.
All right, we have to step away for a break. And we'll pick up right there when we come back. Don't go away, folks. More with Sam Maranto right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest, Sam Maranto. Sam, we were talking about these Bigfoot, and you said they can say words. Has she gotten any recordings of them?
The researchers working with us, which are also Illinois MUFON researchers, they have recordings, yes. They also have footprints. At this point, I don't want to talk about too much of the evidence, but it's a volume of evidence, and it's getting better and better.
Now, when you say they have recordings, is it they have recordings of them saying words?
I think that could be analyzed, and that may very well be the case. Let's put it this way: they talk very fast, so that may be the case.
Right.
There are some linguists that are actually working with Sasquatch recordings and have noted that it is some English and Native American, possibly even French, in their own dialect. But it's very fast.
Okay, what about pictures? Does she have any pictures or video of these Sasquatch?
Some poor pictures. We have castings. We have areas that they've done markings, fingerprints, damage to property. I mean, these things are big, so they have a tendency to break things. They play with the trunk of the car and get into the vehicle. They've gone through her tackle box. The smaller ones have actually been inside the car itself and ripped the rear view mirror off. They have interaction with these creatures. They're in the cornfield while the corn is young, and they're eating it, and they'll be outside talking to them. In fact, the son was walking through an area where he knew they were, and he got hit in the head with a corn cob that was just eaten, you know, where they ate the corn, you know, off of it, and they hit him square in the head, you know.
Well,
so they interact with them.
Okay, and do they carry on conversations with these Sasquatch?
The two of the people do. The son is able to communicate, and they play. In fact, the one adolescent seems, one in particular, likes to play with them and will come to the house and make issues, you know, and all sorts of noise, bang on the door, to the point where it almost sounds like they're going to rip the door off. And they want him to come out and interact. What they do is they play a hide and go seek type scenario, and they're able to see them. They've been out there. The researchers have been out there with night vision, first generation night vision, and actually been able to see them interacting, laying on the ground, jumping up, moving around. They rock back and forth, and able to run at great speeds. And what they do is they attract the witness. When a person's sitting there looking at one individual, another one will make a noise, and by the time you turn and look, the other one's gone. They're pros. They know how to detract your attention. And they're smart as all heck.
So do you think they are human?
I think they're human-like, and most likely either a descendant or, you know, obviously a branch of what would be considered human, and obviously something else, possibly something else. The thing is, we have many of them in Illinois. It's not like we have just one or two instances. Illinois is noted for Bigfoot stories, encounters, and research. We have a good volume of very reputable researchers in Illinois looking at Bigfoot colonies. There's actually locations and towns that have been noted for having colonies or groups of these creatures living there for ages. One of them is in the Seneca area, and that's pretty much well known. And they've been out there for years.
Are there any reports that you're aware of any of these Sasquatch doing physical harm to anyone?
Yes. I think it's a matter of them being cornered. If you're going to attack their young, if you're out there hunting and you decide to take a shot at one, I think that would be in a defensive and offensive mode. There's an old, a story that goes back, I don't even remember how long it was, but 15 people, I believe is what it was killed by one, or was killed by, were killed by one. So, I mean, they can be, these are huge, huge creatures, animals or whatever. They're huge. They range in feet as far as what has been seen with this group. the male, which they refer to as the alpha male, may be as tall as 12 feet tall. The other one, there's a female that's in the range of 7 to 8 feet, and then the other, what seems to be adolescents, are 6 to 7, and then some very smaller ones, some children.
Has there ever been anything, you know, we've heard in over the years in various interviews, people have talked about how they think that these Bigfoot, these Sasquatch, are actually extraterrestrial. Have you come across anything about them that would lead you to think they may be extraterrestrial?
I think there's a correlation with some of these, and I don't know which ones in particular, because it seems as though there isn't just one species of what we call Sasquatch. There's offshoots. And that some of these may very well be either taken as specimens and interact with aliens. Some have been seen with belts on them, with illuminated, let's say, for instance, some sort of apparatus on them. And those, I would say, were probably more akin to something that would be dealing with an alien or with these craft. I don't know if these UFOs are there to collect specimens or if they let the zoo out and they're just checking on these things on and off. I don't know. But there is UFO activity. Usually when there's two, when you have two or more phenomena taking place, in a vicinity, in a relative, you know, within a scope of time, there is a possibility of a correlation. So that may be the case. And it wouldn't be the first time that UFOs and Bigfoot have been seen together. And I think certain areas that may have more phenomena, say, for instance, the Skinwalker Ranch, the area up north that we've been doing research at. We haven't done anything up there this year or 2 years now. But, you know, there is that possibility.
Do they seem to you to be intelligent enough that they could fly one of these UFOs?
Well, it seems as though they know how to erase data on a recorder. It seems as though they're so astute that if you do put cameras out, they know where they're at, they find them. And for instance, with this case, they had hid a small recording device, very well hid, during the day. And the next morning, she woke up and right outside the door, sitting there right on the cement pad in the back door, was the recorder sitting there. Plus, they had a piece of tape over the LED light that would go on once it was on. They covered it up. The tape was off. So these are very intelligent. They watch every move. Their senses are superb. They can tell if a change in the mood, even in the health of somebody. When she was ill, they were very concerned. They were very active. She was in the hospital. They were annoying the mother. They were so unruly because she was gone, because she wasn't interacting. She wasn't out there talking. They are observant of the environment because their life depends upon it.
All right, let's switch over to the UFO activity in that area for a moment. Has anyone, to your knowledge, seen one of these UFOs land?
In the vicinity where she's at, I've had multiple reports. She's no more than, say, 3 miles from another family who had ongoing reports. As far as landing, she felt that one UFO that they've seen recently may very well have landed. I don't think so. But it doesn't mean something can't get out if it hovers low enough. That object in particular was a massive rectangular object with a slew of lights, all these illuminations on the side and underneath it. And when it crossed the road, her daughter thought the circus was in town. It was unbelievable. And there were multiple witnesses in the car. It just so happened that very same object was seen further west of there near a nuclear power plant the next day, and we had even in one more other report. So in other words, her sightings, more times than not, are always with other independent groups or independent sightings in or about the same time period.
Are there any military bases or Air Force bases close enough to this area that we could sort of suspect maybe this is some of their, you know, super duper secret squirrel stuff?
That's a yes.
So what do you think? Do you think it is some of the super duper secret squirrel stuff, or do you think this is ET stuff?
I think some of the stuff that shows up afterwards, I mean, we get some pretty remarkable sightings out there. Some other that show up afterwards may be in pursuit of it, of these things, maybe it'll be our own technology. Now, again, we had, as you may recall, a couple of years back, there's an area that's a hot spot for sightings, and we did many nights out there as far as night watches. I think we had four different groups out there on 8 to 12 nights, and I would say more than half of those nights we came back with positive sighting footage, photographs, etc. So I know we have some pretty remarkable technology flying in and around the area, so some of the stuff, the larger stuff, of course, being military, the smaller stuff possibly DARPA, but the very truly unusual stuff.
All right, we'll have to pick up with the truly unusual stuff when we come back from this break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking with Sam Maranto. Sam, you were about to tell us about the really peculiar sightings.
Well, the peculiar aspects of our side of this all is we have had so many unusual sightings down there, and some of the objects seen are orbs, and recently it's a large white orb or multiple circular lights, very, very bright and opaque, but brilliant. And the other thing is, when the object moved over the house, it actually, there was a guttural tone to it that they were able to feel the resonance. It was resonating in the house like a drum. One thing I did want to point out, some years back, I think it was about 2.5 years ago, I ran into a gentleman who called me pertaining to some of his sightings not far from there, and then some other sightings closer, say, to University Park. One day, he said, when he was coming back from southern Illinois, he went past through this area, and he seen on the side of a road what he described as a reddish-brown, a dead Sasquatch. He says he had no doubt in his mind it was a dead Sasquatch by the side of the road. So There has been accounts of other things that I tucked in back of my head that I completely forgot about until these recent cases.
Okay, so in the area where they're seeing these white orbs, are they also having Sasquatch activity?
Yes, at least in this area. There has been accounts further south and further west of there, and it's also an area where these white orbs have been seen flying around by the side of the road, and they're pretty large. They also have the orange orbs that people see, the orange balls of light. And we had, during July, we had through Illinois, Missouri, Indiana, we had so much activity all into Pennsylvania. In fact, right now there's still tons of activity going on in Missouri at this time. They're doing a good job investigating that.
Have you been able to determine if there is any functional difference between the orange orbs and the white orbs? I know there's a difference in their appearance, but does there seem to be any functional difference or any difference in their performance?
Yes, I think the orange, the funny thing with the orange, I think you've seen them too, haven't you?
Yes, but not up close.
Well, okay, this is the thing that I find interesting. For people who have seen it close, I've seen one, both Julie and I have seen, I've only seen one, and it was at a distance of maybe 3,000 feet, maybe 2,000 feet distance. But it was huge. It was a huge orange orb just sitting in the perfectly still in the sky, and what appeared to be coming from the bottom from it seemed to be oozing a smaller orb that seemed to be coming from the bottom of it, and that was very interesting. But people who have seen this very similar or the same type of phenomena, when they get close to it, see that it actually is in motion in the inside, moving around, swirling about like lava, as they describe it. And there's more coloration. So it's at a distance, it appears opaque, solid, and orange, but brilliant. Mm-hmm. But when you get closer to it, it actually, you get to see a variation in the appearance of the phenomenon itself, and it takes on a different appearance altogether.
What is the functional difference that you've noted between the orange and the white orbs?
The orange, the white, I think, are more of a possibly something in flux, where this or the other objects are a little bit more. Boy, I really can't even nail that one down. But more so, when I hear white, I constantly think it's something in flux, more so. Much like the green fireball phenomena or the crafts that resonate in that frequency where it's or wavelength where it's green. I've seen those too.
Well, do you think these orbs
ones are smaller?
Mm-hmm. Do you think these orbs are somehow organic, biological? Or do you think they are mechanical?
I think yes on all that. In other words, it could be a plasma, a commandeered plasma that serves a function, so it can be a piece of technology. The other thing is, it could be a masking ability for something else, or it could be part of the outer shell of a craft in flux that I've just, you know, I'm just not totally, as far as aware, as far as research-wise. But it is interesting as all heck, and they are beautiful, by the way.
Okay. How long have you been a UFO investigator? How many years have you got invested in this?
Well, prior to MUFON, I've done my own research probably a good 6 years prior to that. So it's about, it's getting close to 20 years.
Okay, we'll round it off and we'll say 20 years. couple of questions. First question, in this 20 years of investigating, do you think that we are any closer now to knowing what's going on than we were 20 years ago?
The public? No.
What about those of you who investigated?
I think many of us will have to come on board with the deduction that Jacques Vallée and Hynek drew and actually got chastised for when they said, that they would be greatly surprised if the phenomena was only a nuts and bolts craft coming from another planet or solar system. Mm-hmm. And that may be and that is where I'm thinking the phenomena is broken up into multiple phenomena. In other words, it's not just it can be intradimensional, interdimensional. It could be something from here. It could be a natural living form that we have no idea about. The other thing is, it could be the manner in which something transcends a dimension and how it appears to us before it completely does come into this dimension. The crafts obviously are discernible as being elliptical, cigar shape, triangular, etc., and they appear solid and until they're in a state of flux, much like anything else in a state of flux. But I think it's a myriad of things, and it's the term paranormal embraces probably everything and probably too much, and it makes it sound hokey. But that's the term it's used, and for a lot of this other undiscernible phenomena or can't be identified at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think if you and I were sitting on Mars and we were natives of Mars, and we saw one of NASA's rovers come across the hilltop, and we observe it for a little while, we might have difficulty deciding whether that thing is a living being or not. It looks mechanical to us, and yet we can observe that it appears to stop, to consider. It does some work. It makes decisions and changes course. It would give to us the impression that though it appears to be mechanical, it also appears to be alive. And, of course, it isn't. There is a mind behind it that is alive, many minds. And they are controlling it, but the thing itself is not alive. All right, we have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're delighted you're here. We are talking with Sam Maranto, and Sam is the Illinois State MUFON Director. And prior to being affiliated with MUFON, was an independent UFO investigator for about 6 years. For a total of about 20 years. And we've been talking about some really unusual cases, one in particular we've kind of focused on, that he and his group have been investigating now. I believe you said for over a year. Is that right, Sam?
The case, the specifics pertaining to that one case started in April, but that area has been active, and we've been investigating that area for well over a year.
Okay. Now, when we went away for break, I had used the example that if you and I were natives of Mars and we're sitting there on Mars having a chat, one of the rovers from NASA comes over the hill and we observe it for a while, I think we would conclude that the thing must be, even though it looks mechanical, I think we would conclude, at least initially, that it must be alive because it appears to be able to make decisions. It appears to be able to decide to go a different direction and then go that direction. We don't see anybody around it. We don't see anybody on it. Nobody's in it. So I think we would probably initially conclude anyway that it must be alive. And I'm wondering if some of these things, like the orange orbs and the white, brilliant white orbs that you described, that show some signs of life, some signs of intelligence. What if it's just somebody's rovers?
Could very well be. As you know, there's a tremendous amount of research being done in Sandia laboratory, you know, and pertaining to plasma energy. And everything that you've just used in your example is what they're heading for and may very well have been able to accomplish with some of the research and some of the application. So who knows what's actually going on in our world, yet alone someplace else. Some of these plasmas I've also seen, or these white balls of light, interact with thunderstorms, and I have a magnificent photograph of such an event. It took place in July of, I think it was 3 years ago, during a thunderstorm. And it doesn't seem to be a ball lightning because it lasts so long. It was observed well over 2 to 3 minutes. And usually a plasma doesn't last that long. I think the longest plasma, or at least piezoelectric discharge, was 90 seconds recorded. So, and it was large. This thing was as big as a Volkswagen, or bigger. So I don't know if it was a craft interacting, or if it was just one of the balls of light. It appears to be just one of these white balls of illumination, be it a plasma or whatever. We don't know what.
Okay. I want to go back. We started tonight talking about this case where the lady is having interaction with Sasquatch, and there is UFO activity as well. I want to go back to that. I think you said that initially she saw the first UFO that she saw, or that she reported, was an orange orb. Is that right?
Yes. She's seen an orange orb, and then she's seen the triangular pattern. That was within 2 weeks. I went down there, interviewed her, and here she mentioned that some years back, I think it was 2007, she had seen this other huge craft hovering above a cornfield. In fact, it had so much impact on the daughter, she had to get some counseling, psychological counseling. So it was pretty dramatic.
Okay, now has she seen any of these white orbs?
Yes, just recently. Mm-hmm. Now what she's seen is it was in the sky, it was a white, she wasn't certain if it was an orb or if it was attached to something, and there were, I believe it was two or three other illuminations, round illuminations, circling it, the central one. And it moved slowly over the house, and when it did, there was this guttural tone, this reverberation that they were able to actually feel, and they felt nauseous. It was very similar to the effect that Sean was explaining when the large triangle flew over his house and the whole house started to shake, and he felt extremely nauseous, and his vision was going. She didn't mention anything about her vision, but a very similar feeling as far as nausea and everything else.
All right. Now, had she, before she contacted you, had she put the two things together in her mind, UFOs and Sasquatch, or were they two separate things?
Actually, she didn't think anything about Sasquatch at all. The reason why is she felt these were aliens. And what happened is, when she started to have all this activity, I didn't ask her about that. I didn't even throw that into the mix until she was out one day fishing at a location not far away, and she noticed these, what she said were was these blue, what appeared to be blue lights in a bush at about hip height. A little bit higher, another set. And then she heard this massive growl, this sound like something was going to attack them. She had no idea. It was louder than a lion. And it startled them. They jumped in the car, ran back. And she says, I've seen these blue lights before, as if it was walking, through the cornfield. Before the corn gets high, and the children, the small Sasquatch have this eye shine that's blue, and as they get older, it turns to yellow, to auburn, to red. And what had happened is, I didn't tell her this, but soon they seen an entire family. They didn't know what it was, but there was these large silhouettes in a distance. Across the road from them, looking at them, clearly looking at them, and they seen the variation in height. And there were four of these beings there, the larger one with the reddish auburn type of eye shine, more the female had more of the yellowish auburn, and then the smaller ones with the blue. So she finally realized these were something. And so I mentioned about the Bigfoot Sasquatch scenario. Well, it just so happens throughout her life living there since the 70s, there has been accounts of large things following her, calling her name. In fact, they had to call the police. There was some large thing following her in the backyard. In fact, one instance, one of these things followed her aunt home and caused a lot of trouble. There's a history in the region of these things causing, interacting with people and harassing people.
Okay, now, you said that her son interacts with them and goes out to play with one of the adolescent Sasquatch. And who else in the family did you say can speak with
the
these?
Brother.
The brother can speak with the Sasquatch?
Yes. In fact, he went out there, and he was throwing a corn cob back and forth into the corn. You know, when it was fully mature, and they would throw it back to him. So they were throwing it back and forth to each other. And he was listening to them, the noises they're making, and he says, this is exactly what we would remember when we were children. These were the things that would, and he was explaining that these things were out there back then, and he recalls this.
Mm-hmm.
So the mother, too, she says they thought they had a prowler, and the father was afraid to leave them at night. He was a truck driver, and he felt they had a prowler and a stalker, bothering the daughter. In fact, this thing was able to call the daughter's name and ask for her. And she personally feels the adult male, the alpha male, was the adolescent at that time. So there may be a long history of her interaction with these Sasquatch in the area. Not just her, but other people in the community.
Who made the first contact? Was it the Sasquatch making the first contact and saying words? Or was it the humans making first contact with the Sasquatch and trying to talk?
Was them making contact with her. The other thing is, as a child, the boy, her son, her youngest son, was sitting in the front room and had mentioned the fact that he was talking to the hairy man on the other side of the window, the big hairy man. And the father seen them too, he says, you know, there's a man peeking in at the window. There's a face over here, but he was ill at the time, and sure enough, he was seeing it too. The mother had seen these things very, very close, just on the other side of the window. She's seen them, you know, point blank. She's seen them eyeball to eyeball. So multiple people, family members, relatives, and a gentleman driving not more than maybe 2 months ago, nearly hit one, and it startled him so much he called the state police, and that was right near the house. Now the other thing is the research center, or the research location of another group that they feel is another group, is not too far from where our researchers have been interacting with these things for 3 years, 4 years. So there seems to be pockets of them, but they feel they may be even communicating amongst each other too.
In other words, the two different groups communicating.
Yes, they found another group recently. There's actually four groups that they feel they're in that area. One further north, one further northwest. Maybe 2-3 miles away from there. And that's one that they just discovered recently. And they have tendencies to stay under, they like creek systems, tributaries, and rivers. They use the waterways to move along. And they can do so without being seen, without any problem. The other thing is they like to collect stuff. I find very interesting. There's a ornamental cement duck. I find this so interesting that these either borrowed from somebody's front lawn or plucked out of the garbage. But either way, they take it with them. They also took a beach ball from the backyard, and then she found it in different locations, brought it back, washed it up, and they would come and take it. Every once in a while, they would bring gifts. There's interactions there. I actually have 3 stones that they put on the front porch. After they startled her one day, there was a big ruckus. They pounded on the door. They nearly broke into broke the hatch on the van and startled the people in the family, etc.
And so what, the 3 rocks are what, a kind of a peace offering?
It's a symbol. Yeah, actually it's known to be like a some sort of, they like to bring gifts. And the 3 rocks were like trying to say, hey, we're sorry for startling you or something like that. But the other thing is she had ongoing things where she'd bring stuff out, and I would say, was anything brought to the window? And she goes, like, what? I go, a feather. And she goes, I don't believe you said this. Sure enough, feathers were bringing feathers to her.
Now, why are feathers important?
Pardon me?
Why are feathers significant?
I'm not really certain the significance of feather, but I knew of a research group in Ohio that stumbled across bunches, you'd get a bunch of feathers, you know, a few feathers together, turkey feathers in particular in this case, and they would use either bark or some sort of twining, natural twining, and hold it together and make things and leave that as a gift. And I had asked one of my researchers one time if he ever stumbled across anything like that, and he says, I'll be doggone. I've been finding these things all over when I'm out there leaving, after I would leave apples out for them, I would find these things, and I couldn't figure out how it was made or, you know, who brought it. And that's what he was finding.
So it appears what they're doing is sort of like saying thank you.
Yes. And this witness down there, all I could say now is she's become a very good researcher. And I'm so happy she's there, you know, and able to record all this information. But she finds him to be very compassionate. The other day, it was about 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, we had a bad storm, and she was down. They come to the door. They walk in the house. They've been in the house. The thing is they need to keep things locked. But if they really wanted to, nothing could hold these things back. They could rip out a door or a window with no problem. But it was banging the front door. And she had gotten upset, you know, and said, you know, she heard him making noise out there, and she was talking to him. And so she had opened the door, and the door was broken loose. So it came back and actually repaired it and pushed it back in. So they try to be responsible. They never take more than they should take. They're like Coca-Cola and Pepsi. So she had put a case of Pepsi out there, and they would help themselves to it. But they would never take the whole case. They would take just cans at a time. And it was very odd the way they would open a can. They would turn the little tab sideways to open it because their fingers are so big. And it crunched the heck out of it, by the way.
Now, you mentioned a case in Ohio. It may be the one I've heard about, where there is a lady who says that these Sasquatch can talk, and that they do talk to her. That one of them comes up to the house from time to time and asks her for garlic. Is this the case you're talking about?
This is actually a university study that's been going on out there. I don't know how far it's progressed, but there was interaction. Down in Kentucky, they have interaction, and there's a group there that I don't know how many generations that they've actually interact with people. It seems as though people who have them just love them. You know, it's their Squatch, and that's how this person is. She's very protective now. It's like her family.
All right, so has she carried on any conversations with them?
Yes, she talked with them, and there's verbal interactions. But as far as this, you know, what they're actually saying, she has no idea. And it's only when they mimic her or they say words. The son, on the other hand, has actually had them talk to him and say either Native American words or English. Very, very clear English. One night, I was telling you about the individuals showing up with high-powered rifles, trying to hunt them down. Well, they cornered one of them up on a roof of a school, and there was, I think, there's four or five of these guys down there, one with a high-powered rifle. And so she was very upset about it, and she asked her son to go down there and scare them off. Well, he shows up, but right when he showed up near his car, sitting in the shadow behind a large dumpster, was one of these Squatch. And the minute he got out, it started growling at him real loud, and he goes, "No, friend." and he gave his name. And it told him in a very deep voice, danger, go. So it has spoke, you know, these things do speak, and they do know meanings of certain words.
Did these guys shoot at the Sasquatch?
No, the things, the one that was there jumped up, and the other one took off. And this one has the better vocalization out of all of them as far as, and it let loose this incredible scream, and it just frightened the heck out of them. They said they were just running. They were just running. They jumped in their cars, and they were gone, and they have not come back. So.
Okay, so what you've just described for us is a close-up, face-to-face meeting and conversation.
Yes.
Is that the only such face-to-face, close-up meeting like that that you're aware of, or are there more?
Oh, they like to watch television. So she was lying in bed, which was next to the wall, and right next to her, she was explaining, no more than a foot away, one was there, and she could smell them, you know, and it was watching the television. And you could hear their teeth chatter. They chatter their teeth. And when the commercial would go on, it would get upset, and its teeth would chatter. And she was just thinking of how, if this thing wasn't, benevolent and just interested in interacting and wanted to do harm, it could easily have killed her. All it had to do was reach in and grab her skull and squish it.
Well, here's another thing. What you've just described sounds very much like this thing, whatever it is, can follow the storyline and knows when a commercial has come on, knows there's a difference. So, this indicates really a much higher level of intelligence than most people, I think, would ascribe to Sasquatch, because we usually hear them described, people say, well, I think it might be some sort of Gigantopithecus. We'll talk about that when we come back from break. We do have a break coming up. But what you're describing does not sound at all like Gigantopithecus. It sounds like something very nearly like us. If it can follow a storyline, and if it knows danger and knows the words to warn you, that's pretty sharp. That's pretty smart. We'll be back right after this.
Gary, listen, we got aliens here taking all our money, and the people that come into this town, they leave broke. I need you to investigate them.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest, Sam Maranto. Sam, when we went away for break, I was saying this doesn't sound like some kind of Gigantopithecus thing.
No. This
is something much closer to us in intelligence.
Yes, the only thing it has, the height, a much larger cranium. It does have the pointed skull and larger eyes. It is the facial features are more human-like, though she says there is another one there that appears to be more simian-looking than the other ones. So she describes variations in the group that she has seen, some being the coloration of an Irish setter, one being more darker brown and one being black.
All right. Are they completely covered with hair, or can she see skin?
She could see skin.
And what color?
Especially in the chest area, mm-hmm. and the face. Some have. One she describes more like a hippie with much longer hair. The other component of possibility here is there a possibility of a feral, group of humans that have interbred with these at some point, and that could be one or two of the others, children. I don't know. Who knows? You hear about these things interacting with people so close, protecting them. There's of course, accounts in I believe it was Russia, where one actually bred with humans and had human-looking children. So who knows? The Native Americans speak of them as if they're another tribe of people. So they don't discount them or look down upon them. They're just the men of the wild, a different tribe, a different race.
And big.
And, oh, doggone big. I get a kick out of the explanations. Then when I get to see the actual casts of these things, one of them has a foot that's about 20-some inches long, where the average of the other ones are about 17 and 15, and then there's the smaller ones. But they're very distinguishably different than human. They're wider up front. They were able to point out the characteristics much better than me. But I think a podiatrist could also see the difference.
How much of this lady's story have your investigators been able to corroborate?
I would say more than half of it. I don't take, as you know me, I take nothing on faith.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a believer. It has to be investigated. I feel there's enough validity to this now, with multiple witnesses. I've seen the rubbings where they've touched and the handprints, they have a tendency also to mark their territory, and all I could say is that's some pretty tall marking. I've seen damage to trees that they've done and through the cornfield, etc. These are big, big creatures. They're not deer.
Mm-hmm.
I know the difference. So.
Yeah, well, a deer track is kind of tiny anyway.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And when the damage they do to corn, I've seen, I have years of experience with that. So what I see here is nothing like that whatsoever. And in fact, the damage that they did to this farmer's crop, acres and acres, these things ate quite a bit of corn when it was delectable before it got hard. So,
Well, are they vegetarian, or do they eat meat as well?
They're omnivores, but they do love deer. So they like their venison. And this is interesting. I would say a lot of this really started to take off when she hit a deer back in April. She hit a deer. The car was brought in the backyard, and all the deer blood, excrement, etc., bits and pieces of hair were on the car. And I'm sure they smelt that, and that's where the activity really got crazy at that point. But they love deer, and they usually follow the deer herds. That's their number one source of protein.
Okay,
now, Snickers, by the way.
This area that she's in, you talked about cornfields. Is it mostly cornfields, or are there some wooded areas for these things to hide in?
Yes, there's pockets of woods, large pockets of woods in some instances. But it's along these tributaries to a main artery river, and this is the thing. There are so many arteries and tributaries, all of which are just surrounded by brush, small trees, large trees, pockets of woods. Mm-hmm. And then there's standing areas of woods and forested areas. And so there's more than enough area for them to live. There's also caves. There's abandoned coal areas where coal mining is done. And abandoned areas of housing, factories, etc. So there's to discount the possibility of them living in a somewhat urban environment, I can't say that's not an impossibility. They could be living in that too.
Have you actually been to this area?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And have you seen any Sasquatch there?
No, but I've seen the prints. I've seen handprints. I've seen the markings. I've seen the damage they've done to trees. I've seen the damage they've done to the car. As far as that goes, the woman was sitting against the car one day, and the girlfriend at that time of the son was on the porch, and they were talking to each other. She seen the girl on the porch seen over her shoulder of the woman against the I believe it's a Durango. One of these creatures' heads pop up, and she jumped. She goes, "Oh, look!" And she says, "It looked like Cousin It, from the Munsters."
Uh-huh.
And it pushed the car, gave out a yell, and it pushed the car sideways in gravel 4 inches while she was lying against the car, pushing her forward, and she fell. These are big animals, creatures or whatever. They're big. And
now prior
to, the adults don't like them. Yeah.
Prior to this case, had you been involved in any Sasquatch or Bigfoot investigation prior?
One other case. And that was on Lorenzo Road, near the Arsenal, Joliet Arsenal.
Okay.
Down that way. And a friend of mine and 4 other people were in the car, and one ran across the road. Then I was indirectly involved with some other research by one of these investigators.
So, how are you looking at this? Are you looking at this as a UFO investigation that has Bigfoot associated with it, or are you looking at this as a Bigfoot investigation?
All three, I think. Yeah, it's a phenomena. When it comes to UFOs, it opens up the door to many other things because of the possibilities of other things being related to it.
Mm-hmm.
The somewhat paranormal phenomena. The other thing is the possibility of plasma being used as a form of intelligence, or to retrieve intelligence, or to be programmed, etc. There's so many different aspects to this, as you know, well beyond the scope of just the nuts and bolts craft, which are the easiest ones to work on. At least you have an idea of, well, it's a craft, it was a triangular craft, but when you have things coming out of craft that don't fit the description of craft, that's different. And then when you have cryptids, and I prefer to call this cryptid, that seems to be associated somehow, some way, possibly with UFO activity, then you have to get brushed up on learning what's going on with this. You know, it's like a learning curve all over again.
And you said earlier that these cryptids, these Sasquatch, seem to disappear just before the UFOs show up.
Yes, they hide, and their activity is curtailed until these things take off, until they're out of the area.
So now, how do you interpret that? What do you think that means?
Well, the last experience that she was explaining, she says, one of them was yiping and carrying on as if it was in a state of fear. And she went to look outside to see, what the heck is, what are they carrying on about? She opens the door, and directly across the cornfield, past some trees, there's this bright light is up in there. She describes it with these, I think she said two or three other illuminations circling around it. And they just couldn't believe it. They're sitting there watching this, and the mother comes over. But the Squatch, on the other hand, they just quieted down and disappeared.
All right. What's the latest encounter that she's had with these Sasquatch? When was the most recent?
The most recent, I didn't talk. Usually we stay in contact daily. I didn't hear anything from her today, but there wasn't very much activity in the last couple days. Nothing major.
All right. Does there seem to be any kind of pattern to when the Sasquatch activity increases? We know it decreases when the UFOs come around.
Yes.
What causes it to increase?
Very dark nights where you don't have a full moon. If you have a full moon before the moon is up, or afterwards, they'll get active.
I got you. All right, now, what about dwelling places? Now, I'll tell you what, we've only got about 15 seconds here, and we have to take a break. We'll get to dwelling places when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, this evening we're talking with Sam Maranto. He is the Illinois State Director for MUFON, and this is a case that involves UFOs and Bigfoot. We'll be back. Welcome back. We're talking with Sam Maranto, and Sam is the Illinois State Director for MUFON. Sam, when we went away for break, I had said, what about dwelling places for these Sasquatch? Have any been found?
Yes. They actually stumbled upon where they're certain at least one group is living. It seems though they have multiple locations that they may have been living at, and they're not sure if it's the same group, just, you know, maybe they're in two different locations, or if it's multiple groups. But they found them. She also found the missing pop cans tucked away into a cinder block, crushed so neatly into it, the very ones that were being taken out of the Durango. Now, mind you, they're going in the car. They broke the latch. As far as to get in there, they just get into it. And So they stumbled across that. They found a few other items that they had taken.
Okay, now these dwelling places, what do they look like?
Padded down areas. Also some areas that are secured by unusual distinctive formations of trees that are bent, sticks. They protect the area by putting, sticks in front of the path, so you'd have to move them and make noise or step on them.
Mm-hmm.
They bend trees in a very unusual way. It almost looks like a teepee. They bend them in on each other. And I don't know what the purpose of that is, if it's for the purpose of marking a territory or whatever. But they also found that they are staying underneath overpasses, smaller overpasses by somebody's tributaries. So they found a lot of footprints and areas of matted down, the mud seems to have been where their buttocks was sitting or lying. We actually have photos of that. So,
okay, now let me ask you
different places.
Let me ask you something here that is a real mystery, and that is, what about burial places? Why haven't we found any?
Yeah, that's a good point, though they think that they actually bury them. And there have been accounts of, say, for instance, these things being seen in the water with the dead of, like, the dead babies and or adolescents or children, and setting them in the water with rocks. So they do bury them, is what the feeling is. Now, the other thing is, it's hard to find skeletons of almost anything in the wild.
Yeah, that's
true. Nature gets rid of a corpse pretty darn quick.
Yeah, that is true. You know, my house is in Thailand. And in Thailand, they used to have wild elephants. They have domesticated elephants now that do a lot of work up in the rural areas in the north. But they used to have wild elephants. And my father-in-law told me that, you know, it was very, very, very rare to find the corpse or skeleton of an elephant. It was
yes.
A big mystery. And that's a huge, I mean, Sasquatch is big, but an elephant's bigger. And, you know, if you can't find an elephant skeleton, then finding a Sasquatch skeleton would be even more difficult.
Yeah, they have a tendency also to hide their prints. The adults will make it a point to be wary of leaving prints, to somehow cover them up. So they're aware of the fact that we are aware of them. But they're elusive. Boy, they know their habitat, and they know how to blend in. That's something that really has taken them by surprise. They could be right next to you and you wouldn't know it unless you smelt them or they wanted you to know that they're there.
And, you know, that kind of indicates something about their intelligence. Not only are they wary, lots of animals are, but from the things you've described and that other people have described here on this show, they're not only aware of our presence, they're not only aware that we are aware of their presence, they kind of have our psychology figured out, and they play us like a fiddle.
Yes, they do. They've been observing us much longer than we have been observing them.
We are just about out of time, and I want to ask you this. What's the long-term plan here? What's the goal?
My personal goal with this, actually, is I think each individual involved, and I don't like to dictate anything as far as only do this or only do that. The only thing I request, and everybody's in agreement on this, is to keep this pretty quiet as far as the location. We don't want any harm coming to them. But my own personal research will be more of a social anthropological research besides the physical evidence. I would love to be able to record their conduct, their interaction, and to do that without the without as much involvement, or should I say changing their environment. See how they actually act as a social unit. And I think that would be a great bit of scientific research as far as anthropology goes. If in fact these are considered human, and I'm thinking they will be in that category. The other thing is there is DNA research being done as we speak by Dr. Melba Ketchum and a few other folks. And if this turns out the way we expect it to, it'll be dynamic, as long as there's no shenanigans.
So there's no plan to capture one?
You know, the thing is, if it's human, you really don't want to. That's the other thing. If it's human, you can't shoot it as far as to get a specimen, or if it's considered human-like. The other thing is, if it's considered endangered species, then there's going to be territory designated to it, and considering the fact it's as big as it is and goes where it wants, well, we can't do that. The other thing is, if it's a Native American, if it's declared Native American, then all of a sudden they get to have rights like any other Native American group. So it's interesting how this all pans out, but I think it's another Pandora's box for those people in charge of making rules, regulations, and laws, and, you know, for the Department of Interior and everything else, who knows.
All right. I want to thank you for being with us this evening. And if you will, stay on the line with me for a moment while we bring this flight of the Kevin Smith Show Starship in for a landing. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it. That's a wrap for this evening. Sam Maranto. And I hope you've enjoyed it. Remember, we're listener supported. Without you, we're not going to make it. My friends generally call me Steagle Eye. Sometimes they call me something else. You can call me whatever you want to call me, just as long as you keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.